The next case is 06489 Ellen Regans et al. Versus Mountain High Coach Works. Mr. Burge.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the court, co-counsel, and also Counsel Sullivan and Mr. and Mrs. Regans. My name is Ronald Burge, and I have the distinct privilege and honor of representing Roscoe and Ellen Regans in this appeal to this court. I would like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal, if I may.
Time there.
Thank you. Fundamentally, what we are here asking this court to do in this case is to interpret and apply a single paragraph, one set of words, which appears in approximately 70% of all of the consumer finance contracts out there in the world, all of the ones that exist across this country, not just in this state. Typically, about 70% of those contracts will have this clause, which is in front of you, which is why it is so important, because it covers nationwide, quite literally, millions of consumers and businesses and financiers who assist those businesses in selling their products. In this particular case, we believe that we have presented this court with what is, in fact, the prime example of why this case and these facts and this clause should be interpreted the way we believe the law supports. First of all, this case shows this court, we believe, why a financier who assists and enables sellers who are unfair and dishonest merchants, why that kind of a financier should ultimately be held responsible for the dishonest acts and damages caused to the consumer by that retailer. In this particular case, we have both an RV manufacturer and an RV dealer that went out of business. We have no one left in this case for Mr. and Mrs. Regans to go to for compensation other than the financier who assisted the seller in selling these goods by providing the financing.
Counsel, I want to just clarify a couple of facts. The original purchase was around $88,000, correct?
Correct.
And the financing amount came to, over the life of the loan, $172-something.
That is correct.
And the judgment that you received on compensatory was $53,000.
$53,000 actual damages.
Yes, actual damages. And that was offset. There's no dispute that that was offset.
Correct.
Okay.
That amount was ordered by the court to be deducted from the balance owed, not to be refunded.
Now, the question I have is, does that come off the 172, or did that come off the 88, and then you only run interest on the remaining 30-some thousand?
It came off the second way, Your Honor. It came off of the principal balance that was owed at the time of the judgment, and then finance charges continued to accrue on the remaining balance that was owed.
So the financing charges were reduced to financing charges on the remaining, let's say if you still had the $33,000 remaining, financing accrued on the remaining $33,000, not the $172,000.
That is correct.
Okay.
The face amount of the note was the $172,000.
Okay. Then the second question I have is, your client kept the vehicle?
Correct.
And it did not sue for rescission?
That's not correct.
It sued for damages?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's not correct. And if I may take this moment to explain, there are two things that appear in this court that in the briefs that need to be explained and clarified, one of which is the statement that they never asked for rescission. Actually, that's not true. If you look at the complaint that was filed in this case, a specific request for rescission was made.
But you weren't awarded rescission.
No, and the reason is because by the time we got to trial, by that point, we had an empty cellar. We had nothing left to rescind with. There was
but
no seller who could satisfy any judgment for rescission or damages.
You still were not awarded by the court the total amount of your purchase price. In other words, the court must have determined there was some value remaining in the vehicle you had to the tune of $30,000, or the jury had to determine it.
Correct.
Okay. And you still have whatever is remaining of that vehicle.
Yes, and what remains of that vehicle is the Hulk that has been sitting in their driveway, unusable, undrivable, because of the way it was manufactured and misrepresented by the seller.
And I understand that you have something that's not usable at this point. What my concern is, the law we're going to write is law that's going to apply to everybody
I agree.
We interpret this. And there may be people who have something that they recovered damages on, and they may recovered triple and punitives against the original wrongdoer. But if we apply what you are asking us to apply against the financer may be left with no contract remaining, but yet the individual is left with a product that still has value. In your case, it may not be the case, but if we accept your proposition of law for all cases, there may be some inequities running the other direction, because you're asking us to assess punitives against somebody who did not do the actual wrong.
And the financer is in the best position to handle that, because when they first arrange for handling the financing by a dishonest dealer, they can establish ground rules under which they will take those kinds of contracts and handle that kind of financing.
But you're really asking us to assess punitives against financers simply because they engage in financing, not because they engage in wrongdoing. And I understand your shifting policy, but when you have a smaller verdict and a larger amount of value remaining, but you shift that whole cost to the financier who did nothing wrong except finance, then you're creating an inequity on the other side too, because you have somebody that could have a lot of value left, but they're not paying a dime left on it anymore.
There is some inequity, I will concede that to Your Honor, but there is a bigger inequity to not doing so. And the reason is because, just as you did in this case, you have Mr. and Mrs. Riggins who walk into a dealership knowing nothing about it. You have a financer who has been handling the financing for that dealership and therefore knows something about it on an ongoing basis. You have Mr. and Mrs. Riggins who are lied to by the dealership and misrepresented the product and the services that they are paying thousands of dollars to buy, not knowing that at all. And you have a financer who has the ability to recoup any and all of its loss. All it has to do is set up that process properly by just simply telling the dealer that they're dealing with, if you're dishonest, we're not going to do anything for you. But also, we want personal security for anything that goes wrong with these finance contracts that you are selling to us, that you are assigning to us, that we are taking.
Counsel, is that the standard in operating procedure in the business? Does that happen?
Yes, it does happen. That's called with recourse. There are certain finance contracts and certain contracts between the lending institution that may be involved and the selling dealer involved, whereby they promise to each other certain obligations, one of which is a standard clause that there is no defense, there is no assertable claim against the viability of the note that is being taken by the bank.
So your clients then, had that type of an arrangement been in place, would not have been able to succeed against First Star, or they would, and First Star then would have recourse with the manufacturer or the seller.
Precisely what you said in the last part.
Okay, and they seller, as is here, is gone, what does that do to that arrangement? How does First Star recover?
First Star, at the time it set up its arrangements with the dealership in the first place, like any other lending institution, could have set it up with recourse and could have set it up with securitization or with sufficient capital preserved to it, such as dealer recourse. Not just dealer recourse, but also dealer reserve. There is, in the financing process itself, dealer reserve agreements between the lender and the dealer, where later on more money is paid to the dealer. They could very easily have established by contract protections so that the lending institution, which is dealing on a regular daily basis with this dishonest dealer, has the ability to go back and penalize that dealer when something goes wrong.
It seems to me we have a clear public policy issue that you're asking us to make, because the Federal Trade Regulation clearly was designed to prevent the case of, you know, financing several deals with a certain person, and then that person is corrupt or dishonest or whatever, and you still have to pay off the whole note. But you're asking us to interpret this reservation of rights language to shift also to the seller or to the financier any punitives and attorney fees assessed against the wrongdoer. That's really a public policy decision we have to make to determine what that language means, because we could easily read that language both ways.
Actually, the public policy of the state of Ohio already appears almost identical to this in the Retail Installment Sales Act, where virtually the exact same language has been adopted for retail installment contracts. This is in a direct loan situation here in the sense that the finance contract here expresses itself as a direct loan, two-party paper. In that sort of a circumstance, only this preservation of rights clause protects the consumer and requires the supplier, the merchant, if you will, and the financer to have their own arrangement between the two of them.
Counsel, how,
go ahead.
How do you deal with the FTC rule that says that the recovery by the debtor is not to exceed amounts paid by the debtor hereunder?
That is actually correct all by itself, but the problem in this case is not just that. I believe that language is correct, and I'm not disputing that. That is the first half of what this appeal is all about. What the Court of Appeals below did on that aspect was correct in the sense that they only required the financing bank in this case to pay back the money it had received as of that point. Our point, however, on this appeal in the second half is that the Court of Appeals did not apply the rest of it. When you look at the purpose, the statement issued by the Federal Trade Commission in 1975, and even when you look at the 1976 guidelines that were issued, what you see in that, as was explained in the Lozada case and in nine other cases that talk in similar vein, in reality, what you've got is a situation where the consumer who has been victimized has a right to take that judgment as a claim or a defense, and they can assert the sword to get back the money they've paid as a claim, and they can assert the defense of their judgment as a set-off against what is owed on the contract balance. And that is precisely what the Hauser case did, which is cited in the brief. The headnote number 9, which I believe is the last sentence or two of that decision, specifically allowed for the set-off on the unpaid balance.
So, counsel, from a legal standpoint here, the Second District got this case right up to a point, right? You
absolutely
agree
correct.
With, was it Judge Grady?
Absolutely correct.
Who said the treble damages provision applies. And the case from the 12th District doesn't fit. But then he stopped it at the, he said would be 53, but they waived it off to, or would be 42, but they waived it off to 53. He took away the treble damages as, or he stopped it at the recovery of what had been paid.
Correct.
Right, and you then rely on what the staff guidelines, where are they, you have in your brief, thus
both
if the seller conducts, conduct gives rise to damages in any amount exceeding the amounts paid under the contract, the consumer may, one, sue to liquidate the unpaid balance owed to the creditor, and to recover the amounts paid under the contract, and or defend in a creditor's action to collect the unpaid balance.
Correct.
So that's where you're saying they went wrong, is they didn't apply
correct.
That.
Our position is that the Court of Appeals, if you take the Court of Appeals decision in this case just the way it lays, if Mr. and Mrs. Reagans had paid off the entire balance before that point, then the bank would have been required under that Court of Appeals decision to follow this rule and just simply give back all the money they've been paid. That may be inequitable, I agree, Your Honor, in some senses, but in their stronger sense, the equity here is in favor of the innocent consumer who never dealt with this merchant, who was never misled by this merchant until they walked in that day.
Well, let me ask you this, going back to the facts that Justice Stratton, I can see how you can read the rule and you can read the guidelines to the rule to get where you want to go, but that leaves this vehicle, which your client testified at a value of $35,000. Now, shouldn't that at least be a deduction from what you're allowed to recover from the bank? In other words, in some fashion, if you're keeping a $35,000 vehicle, that's what your client's value, you owe the bank at least that.
This case, in that sense, I agree in part of what you're saying there, Your Honor. This case, like the other two that preceded this in oral argument, argue about the law and argue about the equities of the facts. If we could give back this RV to the bank and cancel everything and get back their money, that would be a different world than what we live with within the confines of this law. Within the confines of this clause, we can only do certain things. We cannot rescind except against the seller, and we have nothing there. All we can do is take the sword and the shield, which is this preservation of rights clause, and use it. And that's all we ask this court to do as well. I see my time has run out for now, and unless there's any further questions, I would like to sit down at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, may it please the court and opposing counsel. This is a case where the language in the rule is absolutely unambiguous. It says recovery hereunder shall not exceed amounts paid hereunder. This is a case where I think the court is called upon to decide whether that language will be ignored or whether, notwithstanding its lack of ambiguity, the court will search into other materials, the guidelines, commentaries, things that
counsel,
were not enacted.
You can read it that way. And let's back this up. Say this vehicle's, you know, they've paid you $3,000 and everybody else is gone. As you have this fact situation, but the amount paid is small and you have a worthless vehicle. Is that the way the FTC set this up so that they give you $3,000 and they've got a vehicle, let's say $35,000, because that's what they said it was worth. They've got a $35,000 vehicle that they paid $85,000 for.
No, we think that if the consumer chooses rescission, they can choose to make the rescission against the lender, the creditor.
So they could have just given you the bus back and walked away clean.
Yes. They cannot recover.
So the error here was on their part in terms of choice of remedies.
Well, we don't believe that's an error. We believe that that was an intentional decision they made with the hope that the treble damages and attorney fees ultimately could be recovered from the only financially solvent party still around, the bank. And that is important for this court because that's effectively what these cases will become. And if it is true, although it's not in the record, as Mr. Byrd suggests, that 70% of loans made by financial institutions like this are consumer loans, that's what that means, that these banks will be sued directly in each of these cases for seller misconduct.
If they have the right of rescission, let's try to be practical about this. Now, you've got their fact pattern, and they're sitting there with this vehicle that's not what it was supposed to be. Do you file all of these things, or do you have to make a choice before you ever file which way you go? And in other words, they're sitting there. He's saying we can't get rescission because the company and the dealer are gone, and we can't get it against the bank. And you say you could, but you're sitting here as a practitioner, and this case hasn't been written yet, so you're not quite sure what you can do. Can you file it all and then get in court and have a judge help you straighten out what's the realistic way to go?
We think it's very simple, especially if it's true that the creditor lender stands in the shoes of the consumer. You sue them directly. And it's well established that you don't have to make your choice between rescission and keeping the vehicle and recovering damages when you file your pleading. It's established by case law, which really has never been questioned, that you make that decision before the trial begins, but only then, so that at the time of trial you decide, now this is the way I wish to go, rescission or money damages. The problem that we see here is that the Ohio Consumer Sales Practices Act, which is what we're talking about here, already describes unequivocally the public policy of Ohio, which is that financial institutions are not subject to it and are not liable for treble damages or attorney fees. In fact, they cannot directly be sued by the Reagans, even if they believe that First Arc committed an unfair, deceptive, or unconscionable act or practice. The result of the argument of the appellants in this case is that that means nothing. For 70% of loans out there now, the Consumer Sales Practices Act will be fully enforceable against financial institutions because they will simply use the Preservation of Rights Clause, the promissory note, or the retail installment contract, and file their complaint against the financial institution. Offer as proof, not that the financial institution did something wrong, but that the seller did something wrong. And then, from that combination, say to the loan, to the lending institution, you effectively owe treble damages and attorney fees. To
well, then you're disagreeing with Judge Grady as well, because he said you can get treble damages, it's just capped by what you paid.
Correct. Correct. We believe that the law in Hardeman, which has been...
So you would not, you're not really, even though at the conclusion of your brief, you urge affirmance, because that's the way I read your brief, you really disagree with the Court of Appeals, but at your conclusion, you urge affirmance of the Court of Appeals.
Well, you have to affirm or reverse the result of the Court of Appeals.
Well, you could say we urge this result for different reasons.
Well, that is what I thought I was doing in the brief, and I certainly would wish to then to supplement it orally at this point in time. The result, we believe, was the proper result. We don't agree with the reasoning. Believe that this court should follow Hardeman and the dissent in this and the other cases all across the country, even the cases cited by plaintiff. Although you do get into some strained argumentation at points, they themselves refuse to enforce attorney fees against lenders. Some of them reasoning, for example, that attorney fees were not paid here under. They were not paid under the note.
Didn't Hardeman predate, isn't that what Judge Grady said, it predated some of the statutory?
No. No, the FTC, language. The Ohio Consumer Sales Practices Act was 72, the FTC rule was 76, and Hardeman was 1988. But these other cases straining to reach what is, we submit, the proper result, do things like argue and say, attorney fees were not paid under the note, so they can't be recovered from the lender. Clearly, treble damages have never been paid by any consumer or borrower, so how could they be recovered from the lender? This remedy, which already exists, gives the consumer the full measure of the recovery. The other problem we have is, you know, the FTC promulgated a rule. This was not a statute written by Congress. This is merely a rule that says we, pursuant to this congressional authority we have, announced that it would be unfair for merchants to sign retail contracts or take money from promissory, from consumer loans without this language in there. The effect of plaintiff's argument is to take that FTC rule, not a congressional statute, and elevate it to the highest law of the land, which is not, even if you read the guidelines and commentaries and go beyond the unambiguous language, that's not the intention of the FTC. They said this will, in fact, be decided on a state-by-state basis. Courts out there sitting day in and day out will look at the equities of the situation. They will apply it to the facts before them.
So, counsel, when you talk about the rescission, I just want to understand what the result would be in this case. It's an $88,000 RV. The financing was $172,000, right? Now tell us how it works if they sue the bank for rescission.
Okay, let's say they sign the contract to borrow $88,000. Total of payments will be $172,000. 2 months later, they realize they can't drive it. They've made two monthly payments of approximately $1,000. They seek to rescind. The only cash they can get back from the bank is the $1,000. Then they tear up the note. It's that simple.
And they return the vehicle to the bank.
Correct. Then they've rescinded the transaction, and that honors the second sentence of the rule, which says recovery hereunder shall not exceed amounts paid hereunder. They're not actually getting any cash from the financial institution beyond what they actually gave to the financial institution, which seems to be clearly the import of the rule. In this case, what we have is an attempt to avoid that, to recover now and in every 70% of these cases, recover directly from the bank or the financial institution treble damages and attorney fees.
Well, counsel, if what you said in the scenario that you just went through, all they get back is the $3,000 that they had paid, and they jettison the vehicle as now the bank's problem to deal with, yet they have to hire an attorney to do this. And so they are disadvantaged by not being allowed to have attorney fees as part of that procedure.
It is unfortunate, but that is what the Consumer Sales Practices Act says. It says financial institutions aren't even subject to it, along with some others, lawyers and some others included. It also, even for regular run-of-the-mill merchants, excuses them from payment of attorney fees whenever they can demonstrate that what occurred in the case was a mistake, despite the maintenance of procedures reasonably adopted to avoid error. So it's not automatic. It's not automatic under Ohio law that consumers always get attorney fees. The only real exception is the Lemon Law, which does not apply in this case. And in this case, what really happened is the manufacturing company put something on the market which was unsuitable by plaintiff's evidence. It was a little too heavy for the Ford chassis. That manufacturer's wrongdoing is not what we're debating between appellants and appellees in this case, because this language only talks about the seller. What happened in this case was the seller bought the motorhome from Mountain High, turned around and sold it to Paul Sherry, and there was no evidence in the record in this case that Paul Sherry knew when they sold the motorhome to the Reagans that it was too heavy. That was not the evidence at all. The evidence at trial was it was too heavy. They took it back. Ford said we can't fix it because the chassis is what we built, and this box is something somebody else built. The dealer said, we don't build these things. We can't fix it, and Mountain High was gone.
But in a rescission, if the seller had not been bankrupt, they would have been able to recover their attorney fees from the seller.
From the seller, yes, they would have.
In this case, we've got a little twist because the seller is non-collectible.
Exactly. So in the ordinary course, in this case, they would have recovered attorney fees. I would also add that this is not really of the national level. Not only, it's not really a national case for the additional reason I should say that treble damages are pursuant to the Consumer Sales Practices Act, which was initially a uniform act, but Ohio and only about a handful of states ever adopted that. So that's really the reason that one of the reasons I think we're here today is so few other states permit the recovery of treble damages in a case like this that it just hasn't come up, but that this is not going to affect every consumer all across the state. And we think this court properly should look at Ohio law and the interaction between the Consumer Sales Practices Act, how it does or does not affect financial institutions, and the FTC rule, and not try to make some national kind of legislation or remedy.
Counsel, you had said you agree with the result of the Court of Appeals, but disagree with the reasoning. Can you just briefly summarize how you differ in the reasoning agreeing with the result?
Okay. The award of compensatory damages pursuant to the remitter was about $55,000, roughly the difference between what they paid and the $35,000 that Mr. Reagans testified it was worth. Although that was a little more than they had paid as of the time of trial, that difference was not raised on appeal. So we agree with the Court of Appeals. We waive that $9,000 difference. But the entry of judgment against the bank, effectively to return that, although it is true that plaintiffs chose instead to have that applied to the principal to reduce the future interest, but that result is exactly accurate. They got an award for compensatory damages of that amount. It is enforceable against the financial institution pursuant to the clause, and that's the end of the inquiry. We don't even believe the Court of Appeals, really, I think it's fair to say that their discussion about treble damages and attorney fees is complete dicta, because the amount of the compensatory damage award was more than they had paid. So there was no reason for them to start talking about treble damages and attorney fees than to say they can't be recovered.
But you disagree even if it's dicta, you disagree with the Court of Appeals resolution of that issue when it says that. I think it's like going through a dense forest, the opinion. It's a difficult case, but that the plaintiff could recover treble damages and attorney's fees from the bank.
You disagree.
That's the way I read it.
Yes, yes, yes.
And your reason for that is that the Ohio Consumer Sales Practices Act prevents that from happening, or is it that clause? The FTC clause.
We believe the FTC clause should be interpreted to reach that result, with the court finding the public policy behind that in the Consumer Sales Practices Act, which itself answers, we believe, the question you are confronted with. Can the consumer, the borrower, recover treble damages and attorney fees against the lender? Look at the consumer.
Yeah, that's the issue. Irrespective of this case on the law, your argument is that under the law of Ohio, that a consumer cannot collect or receive
Correct.
Treble damages. In which section?
13-4501, the definition section, where it explains who are suppliers that are subject to the region.
You've now explained it. You're asking us to engraft that on the FTC rule.
No.
Because there's nothing in the Consumer Practices Act that gives them any right against the bank, right?
Correct. But the judgment that the plaintiffs recovered against the dealership was under the Consumer Sales Practices Act. Now they seek to recover that judgment for the dealer's wrongdoing against the lender.
Yeah, but with the remitter, I mean, I can't, I guess we can't tell, probably doesn't matter, but it sounds like the jury gave them the $200,000 as general damages and not as treble damages, and the judge knocked it back, saying you went about this the wrong way or something.
Well, yes, because there was no evidence in the record of compensatory damages of $182,000, which was the jury's verdict. The nearest that anyone could guess, and we believe that strictly is what it would be, was guess, is that, well, if the jury looked at the total of payments due under the contract, it's $172 and change, and we're not sure how they came out to the $182. Maybe there was some other expenditures for repairs, et cetera. But their intention clearly was give these people back all of their money. Now, they weren't specifically asked whether that was an award of rescission or not, because they didn't realize, we don't think, that what had happened was a conversion from rescission to actual treble damages had been made strategically at the start of the trial.
Counsel, just one final thing. The definitional section that you're saying applies, are we talking consumer transaction under A or supplier under C? Or what is the definitional section that you say says that a bank is not covered by the CSP?
Well, it doesn't use the word bank. It refers, and I wish I had the copy here. It refers to, it might be the consumer transaction section where it says it does not include transactions between.
All right, you're talking A then, consumer transactions.
Right, attorneys
Thank
and
you.
Clients and doctors are exempt. I think dentists are exempt as well in financial
okay.
institutions.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank
there
you,
are a lot of red lights up here, but I think I am done.
The red light
Thank
is for you.
Much.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Burge, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Yes, if I may, very quickly, Your Honor. First of all, I want to point out this is a case where Paul Sherry, the selling dealer, misrepresented the warranty and knew at the time it sold the vehicle to my clients that the manufacturer was going out of business. That's the evidence at trial. Also, in terms of who we can rescind against, the sales contract and the finance contract are two different pieces of paper. The sales contract, which is on page 109 of our brief, specifically has in it the usual integration clause that says that the front and back of this is the whole deal. You cannot rescind the sale of a vehicle against anybody except the seller. We can't rescind against the bank, which is exactly why it is so critical that the preservation of rights clause be interpreted what we believe to be correctly. And we ask that this court affirm.
We have some legal issues to decide here, and I'd like your view, your strongest argument in opposition to the appellee's argument that 13-4501A simply does not include financial institutions.
That's an easy one, Your Honor, and the reason is because that's a red herring. We're not here because of that. We're here because of the preservation of rights clause. By contract, the bank agreed that it would be liable and subject to all claims and defenses against the seller of the goods by its contract. We're not here because we sued the bank under 1345. Saying the bank isn't directly liable is accurate for 1345, but we didn't sue the bank there. Nations Credit versus Phoenix, and that's PH, is a Second District Court of Appeals where that issue was analyzed correctly. And what the Court of Appeals in this case did was extend the implications of that and hold the bank liable under this preservation of rights clause. That's where we are. The last thing I would like to point out, I started to mention that we asked the court to affirm that part of the Court of Appeals judgment where they held the bank liable for return of the monies that were paid. And we asked the court to reverse that part of the Court of Appeals judgment, which failed to allow these consumers to take the judgment against this seller, which the bank had enabled to continue in business when it was dishonest, and assert that as a set-off against the bank. The bank has a remedy.
Is there any evidence in the record? I knew you made that statement, but the appellee says there's no evidence in the record here that shows that the bank was in concert with the dealer. That the bank doesn't like the dealer either, I would guess. I mean, the dealer went out of business. Now the bank is left with a bad deal. I mean, what is there any evidence in the record to support your statement that the bank here somehow was a part of this bad transaction?
Yes, Your Honor, and that appears at trial where the dealer's representative called to court to testified that they arranged for the financing of this with the bank. They set it all up with the bank. It is a loan that would not have occurred with this bank but for the dealer's action.
Well, but that always, isn't that oftentimes the case?
Not
that,
always.
That doesn't mean that the bank knows that the dealer's going to go out of business, does it? Is there some duty on the part of the bank here that you're alleging that the bank failed in its duty to determine the solvency of the dealer here?
The failure at the bank is not a duty to the consumers, but a failure to itself for having failed to set up its transaction in these financing deals with the dealer so that it would be protected in the event that a dealer was dishonest and went out of business, leaving it holding the bag. The bank could have taken steps to prevent that, to police the activity of the merchant here, and it didn't. That's the fundamental purpose of the FTC.
That's a little bit of a bootstrap, but you're saying the bank then would have the funds to pay the customer who's out. I mean, that's a bit of a bootstrap. That's not a legal argument, certainly.
That is exactly this clause, Your Honor.
Pardon?
With all due respect, that is exactly the effect of this clause and the effect of the FTC rule and the effect of the Hauser case, which, by the way, did allow triple damages and attorney fees to be asserted against the unpaid balance. And it's also the effect of the Lozada case and its discussion on the
counsel, are you saying that the bank could have insulated itself from liability here?
Absolutely.
All right. Where would that have left your client?
That would have left them exactly where we wanted them to be, which was getting back the money from the bank, wiping out the balance, and letting the bank do exactly what it did do, which was file suit against the dealer. The bank can recoup its loss directly.
It could not have insulated itself against liability to your client. You're
correct.
Just saying that they could have had a better business arrangement between the seller and the bank.
Absolutely. And they would have insulated themselves from any economic loss if they had done so.
That's not our interest here, is it? That's not an issue in this case, whether the bank and the seller should have had a better business arrangement. That's not...
Well, I agree that's not an issue. What it is, however, is the reasoning and logic behind the FTC statement and rule.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.